Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, and most of you know I'm the creator and host of this series. For anyone who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series of deep conversations to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by asking a particular question. How can higher consciousness play a key role in helping human beings rise to meet our current challenges and make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet? This is part of a series of truly remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders, spiritual teachers, which you can access by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. And today, I'm really happy to be joined by David Gershon. The way we'll continue that discussion will be to have a conversation we're titling Evolving the Way We Change the World. So I'll introduce David, and we'll spend about an hour having a real conversation, a living conversation that explores this topic authentically. And then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, so we'll finish up in about 90 minutes, or perhaps just a little longer. David Gershon is one of the world's foremost authorities on behavior change, community empowerment, and large systems transformation. As the co-founder and CEO of Empowerment Institute, which he created with his wife and work partner, Gail Straub, his clients include cities, large organizations, government agencies, and social entrepreneurs. He's addressed many issues ranging from low-carbon lifestyles, livable neighborhoods, and sustainable communities to organizational talent development, corporate social engagement, and cultural transformation. Early in his career, David used his empowerment proficiency to conceive and organize, and this was at the height of the Cold War, one of the first major global consciousness-raising initiatives on the planet, the first Earth Run. He built on his background as the director of the Lake Placid Olympic Torch Relay and used the mythic power of relaying a torch of peace around the world to engage the participation of 25 million people in 62 countries. The world's political leadership, and through the media, an estimated 20% of the planet's population. Millions of dollars were also raised as a part of this event to help UNICEF provide care for the neediest children in the world. And he's continued in that vein. He's been working for 30 years, and the empowerment programs he has designed have won many awards. Major academic study described them as unsurpassed in changing behavior. He's lectured at Harvard, MIT, Johns Hopkins. He's served as an advisor to the Clinton White House and to the United Nations on behavior change and community empowerment issues. He's the author of 11 books, including the award-winning Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World, and the bestsellers The Low-Carbon Diet, A 30-Day Program to Lose 5,000 Pounds, and with his wife, Gail Straub, Empowerment, The Art of Creating Your Life as You Want It. One of the things I most appreciate about David is the intelligence and sensitivity with which he flows when working with people who don't share worldviews or vocabularies. We're both members of the Evolutionary Leaders Group founded by Deepak Chopra, and in the process of preparing for our upcoming meeting, he and I have become natural allies and have collaborated gracefully and naturally and overcome some interesting stuck places. I can really see why he has been described as a graceful revolutionary. Another thing I really appreciate is his ambition and his track record. He's worked with world leaders like Ronald Reagan, Mikhail Gorbachev, China's President Li Xinyan, and Al Gore, as well as millions of ordinary people who've been impacted by his work. But perhaps most impressive is the rigor of his thinking. His book, Social Change 2.0, which I highly recommend, is a detailed blueprint that lays out the lessons he's learned over his decades as a change agent, broken down into practical principles that can be used as step-by-step guidance in virtually every step of world changing. He's consistently insightful, thoughtful, compassionate, visionary, and street savvy. And the book is truly breathtaking in both its granularity and its scope. So welcome, David. I'm really happy to have you on this program with me today.
Terry, thank you for that amazing introduction. I want to make sure I have that on tape somewhere whenever I need a little hit. Thank you, my friend.
Okay. Well, I'm going to boost your volume a little bit.
Because, okay.
It was a little scratchy there, but hopefully we'll be able to hear you clearly.
Is this any better, Terry?
I think it is a little bit better.
Good.
If we need to boost it more, Brad, let me know and I'll say something.
Great.
Well, let's lead off by asking a very basic question. You know, you've been a lifelong change agent. You've been studying change itself, refining tools for facilitating it. Could you begin by telling us just briefly what it is that inspires you, just shooting from the hip and just laying out the essence of what's at the center of the bullseye of your work and passion?
That's a great question. Thank you, Terry. Well, one of the things that has been an organizing principle for my life is a question that I always am asking at different levels of scale. And the question is, what's possible? And what that does is it opens up a whole array of responses. And it's a very different question than what's wrong and how do we fix it. It really opens up the imagination when you ask what's possible. So my question and what excites me, inspires me, is the thought of how we could evolve into a new way of living and being on this planet, literally block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, community by community, country by country. And I have learned over the course of my work to work at all those different levels of scale. And I've also learned that it all starts with the individual and that person believing that another possibility could come into existence. So that's one cut of that question. I'm sure I could, you know, touch different parts of it, but that's a start.
Great. Okay. Well, that kind of begs a core question that I wanted to get into because, you know, we focused here on being the change. These series of conversations, a lot of them had to do with awakening a higher level of consciousness. And, of course, I've always pressed those who focus on spirituality to connect that inner work with the outer work. You focus on both personal transformation and social change. What do you see as the essence of the connection and maybe the ways in which they each need to be featured, you know, independently, in which, you know, in what ways are they the same and in what ways are they different and how do they connect and what do we need to pay attention to?
Well, I think that's really a fundamental question, is how to bring the inner and the outer together. Because unless you have come from a place of personal development, personal power, personal awareness, it's difficult to do the social change work because you project your unresolved issues and often are in reaction to the issue you're trying to address, the social change issue. So it's very critical that social change agents come from a place of self-knowledge, self-awareness. And secondly, what I have found is that one of the accelerators of personal development or spiritual development is the ability to apply what you are trying to do in a personal or spiritual sense into the work. You know, as you were saying earlier, you know, the work that you and I are trying to do in this particular leadership community required us to work on ourselves to be able to do it with skill and effectiveness. Otherwise, we can become part of the problem. So it demands a level of spiritual development to be effective in the world if you want to actually create a transformational impact and not just what I would call a reaction or an attempt to be in protest of something you don't like. But to actually create transformation, you actually have to come from that deeper place of self-knowledge, in my experience.
Yeah, yeah. But you also are someone who kind of emphasizes the importance when you're dialoguing with people whose focus is on personal transformation of taking it beyond the personal. And I'm curious where the essence of that is, because you didn't speak so much to that aspect.
Well, I think that's the other side of the equation. Unless you are applying your own sense of an enlarged self, a more awakened self, into the world and attempting to bring that kind, not necessarily that specific awareness, but attempting to make the world a better place, then you don't really get to grow. You get to stay safe and insular within your own practice. So it's the actual application that takes you out into the world. Now, the other side of the equation is that I deal with lots and lots of activists. More often than not, I deal with activists who do not have a lot of self-awareness. And so there, my work sometimes is to invite them to become more self-reflective so we can debrief and talk about the processes that are at play, not just the outcomes. So process and product, if you will, outcome and means to outcome. So it's a really an integration, to use the word that you guys use so well, integral, of the social and coming in and the personal and going out. And that's been my path, my entire life. It's come, actually, interestingly enough, out of a spiritual path. It's not so much that I looked at the world and said it's bad and I want to fix it, as much as I actually grew to the place where I said, okay, the core of my philosophy and the core of my work around empowerment is the ability to envision and create what I want in my life, asking what's possible for my life and then attempting to create it. And what comes out of that question is, okay, well, what's the next layer out? Well, that's my community or my organizations that I work with or my country or my world. So it's a very natural evolution once you start to empower yourself to realize you have huge capability to make an impact. And I would add one other thing that you spoke to very kindly, my book, Social Change 2.0. But one of the things that also motivates people to take action is the ability to actually be impactful and or effective. And many of the models of social change are not very effective. So people often pull back from feeling ineffectual or impotent or frustrated by the systems or the organizations they're trying to change. So part of what also enables someone to go into action is greater levels of impact or skill and effectiveness. And so that's another area that I focused on. It's core to any empowerment philosophy is not just the ability to envision and create, envision what we want, but the tools to create it. And a lot of my work has been building those kinds of tools.
So let me ask some more fundamental questions as we begin this dialogue.
Sure.
I think you're laying out something that in what you've just said, we're really kind of still at the bedrock of things. And let's stay there.
Okay.
So how does change happen? And how much can change, both personal and societal, but particularly societal change, really be quickened? And to what degree is that quickening predictable? Is it, you know, when you're lucky and you have a moment in which change is ready to happen, you can maybe play a facilitative role? Or is it possible in a stuck system to facilitate change? What's the essence of what you've learned about the nature of change, its amenability to quickening, and how to be an effective facilitator for it?
Well, those are big questions. So let me start at a natural place that I tend to start with that kind of question, is what is the most critical foundation for getting change to happen. And the answer is relatively simple, and that is a ability to help someone block a leader of an organization, a department, an organization, a city agency, an NGO, whatever level you want to work at, a country, envision a new possibility. Because once you have a vision of possibility, you change the dynamics, and now you have what I call a pull in the system, as opposed to a push. And when you have a pull, something that someone wants, almost like sunshine that you really want to go toward, the job of the change agent is significantly enhanced because you don't have to force change or push or facilitate as much as enable someone to create what they want. And one of the things, I'll fast forward to the last page of my book. It's some 400 pages, so there's a lot that's come before it. But when the question comes down, and you haven't asked it yet, but I will preempt the question, if in fact it was going to be a question, do you feel hopeful about the future of humanity? Is it possible for us to really change? Can we make it as a species? Which is the first question I ask people in one of my trainings on transformative leadership, because that determines how impactful they'll be ultimately, how they answer that question. But when I answer that question, what I get is that what gives me hope is that every single person wants to have a better life. And if you can show them how to have a better life and also have a better life by improving the larger conditions around them that allow them to have a better life, piggyback on top of their own self-improvement aspirations, you have the mechanisms to create a better world. And ultimately, it is the intrinsic motivation to make one's life better, which is distorted right now in all kinds of ways towards material types of things, which aren't in any way bad by themselves, but that's not the deepest thing that people want. They want meaning, they want purpose, they want self-efficacy, they want community. But when you can enable that, then you have the means to move something to a new place. And ultimately, that's a variation on helping someone to see a different possibility and move toward it. So that's the organizing principle of Social Change 2.0, of my personal empowerment work, of everything that I do. And it's trying to be elegant. If I have to do all the work, the push, I will wear down. I will burn out. And ultimately, if I go away, the person goes back to where they were before. But if I can help someone see a possibility, a vision, and give them the tools to go toward it, we have the possibility for forward movement.
That's really the key. And yet there's tremendous... there are tremendous forces that tend to discourage that. One of the things that I concentrated on, I haven't told you this, David, but about 10 years ago, I spent about 2 years writing a manuscript I haven't published, one that I'm now evolving and preparing to publish in the next year or two. But the 2 years I focused in on a book which was the working title was The Terrible Truth and the Wonderful Secret, Answering the Call of Our Evolutionary Emergency. And it was a kind of a put my eyeballs in a vise and look at all the things that I needed to account for in order to find my way to my own positive hope. And I had to look at a lot of things that tend to discourage me. And one of the things I focused on was both the tremendous force of denial in the individual human psyche and in our collective psyche, the way the collective trance of culture tends to operate, and the hesitance people have to hope because they feel, we all feel, discouraged on so many levels when we have hope that something can change. Like even recently when we first elected Barack Obama, there was an incredible upwelling of hope. And what has followed since his election, although he hasn't been such a disappointment as an individual to many people, it has certainly not fulfilled all our hopes. And it's kind of like we're a bruised lover who's, you know, been rejected so many times and dares not love again. Plus, there are all these sort of structural forces. The fact that mass communications are driven by profit, you know, profit motive companies trying to capture eyeballs and sell advertising, all of which tend to turn us into consumers, all of which tend to perpetuate the trends. There's an awful lot of locked-in systems that tend to make it hard for us to really believe that we can turn things around as fully as they need to be turned around. And that then becomes a self-perpetuating prophecy of discouragement. And when I look at how fixed all that is, how apparently intractable and persistent, you know, even when we break through it, it kind of rears, it's like a little bit like the Gorgon, the Medusa, you know, it grows new heads where we lop off the old. How do you find your way, you know, acknowledging and looking squarely at all those patterns? How do you find your way to your own positive vision? Because clearly you're very inspired consistently over a long time, and you're not unrealistic.
Well, I mean, this is why I wrote Social Change 2.0. And part of what I concluded, firstly, let's be clear. We're not that you were totally clear, but let me affirm that the current state of where we are is in a critical place for the species to succeed, and it's not just the things that you've described. The most critical system is the destabilized climate that is on a crash course with reaching a tipping point. Once it's reached a positive tipping point, we lose control of the climate, and then we are on a path to a highly degraded human experience, huge mass migration from coastal cities, and possibly extinction. So that means there's a lot at stake. There has never been as much at stake any time in human existence on this planet. And I would also say that every major social system, whether it's healthcare or education or financial, is in a unstable place, not performing, and some are breaking down. So we have multiple stresses in our world. But as change agents, which is really the target audience that I spend a lot of my time with, we have to upgrade our skill set. And this is where I distinguish between social change 1.0, which is relatively impotent in the face of these kinds of needs, and social change 2.0, which is designed to work with those kinds of challenges. And let me make the distinction between the two, and then we can talk about the 2.0. So social change 1.0 is a model that has not really changed much in the last couple of hundred years. And that model is got three primary prongs. One is social change through laws, command and control, and we're watching that play out in our national scale or international scale with lots of frustration of everyone because it's not designed for the kind of change required now. And I'll speak about that kind of change in a moment. The second one is financial incentives. Pay people to change or penalize them and consequently impact them by economic means. And the third is social protest or, you know, complain about or lament or confront the system and try to get the laws passed or the financial incentives. And so it's kind of a vicious cycle. You're protesting to get a change happening that can't happen anyway, and so there's a lot of frustration in that model. And it has a point of view about human beings as well, implicit in it, which is that human beings either have to be forced to change or paid to change. They won't change because they want to change. And that can work if you have incremental change requirements. But when all your systems are in a state of stress, you need a different kind of change, which in systems theory is called second-order change, as opposed to first-order change, which is incremental. Second-order change is transformational. It requires the system to move to a higher level of performance and social value, which is the definition of second-order change. And Social Change 2.0, the book I wrote, was designed to further second-order change. Now, it's easier said than done because it's hard to do transformative social change. And it requires a commitment and a discipline and a rigor and a knowledge, and it's doable. And second-order change and Social Change 2.0 has come out of 30 years of trial and error to build this model. But enough successes to give me confidence that if understood and carefully deployed, and when there is a commitment to iterative learning, what I call social learning, by trial and error, you can build the social innovations and create the new. That's a long answer, but it was a big question you asked me.
Yeah, and that was a very rigorous and detailed answer. I really appreciate it. I feel like we're getting into the guts of this. Now,
thank you.
This vision of social change 2.0 is one that addresses an issue I've felt very often. One of the things that I know you talk about is that there's a process of the diffusion of innovation, and the discouragement I sometimes feel because even, for instance, in this broadcast, I sometimes do feel like I'm preaching to the choir. I may be frustrated about the deadlock in Congress, or I may be frustrated about our inability to actually institute governmental policies that would allow the United States to be a leader in addressing climate change. And here I am, I'm talking to people who are all voting for more environmentally minded candidates, maybe even contributing money and volunteering, doing a lot of things responsibly in their own lives, recycling, et cetera, et cetera. So I sometimes feel as though I'm preaching to the choir. But you've made the point that this is actually perhaps more powerfully effective than I realized. And this whole model of how innovation diffuses and how the early adopters, which we all are on this call, have an important role in terms of getting clarified and building our skills and becoming more effective, even though at some level we're already converted. And I think that's very germane to the whole context. Like, people listening may be feeling, well, this is great, but here we are, this tiny minority, which kind of agree, we all agree with each other about these things. How is this conversation going to enable us to break the deadlock? And I think maybe you could help us see that more clearly by explaining that larger view.
Sure. Well, it's not quite as simple as preaching to the choir versus not preaching to the choir. In the context of Social Change 2.0 and the diffusion of innovation and the research that that comes out of a man named Everett Rogers from Stanford University, what he studied over 50 years of studying innovations, that's to say he studied 50 years of innovation, some 1,500 innovations, and he was interested on what allowed those that were able to diffuse, to disseminate, what allowed that? What was the process? How did diffusion of the innovation work? He wrote a book called Diffusion of Innovation, which has been picked up by marketers. But I picked it up from the point of view of social change, and it was a really seminal piece of thinking for me. But the key to it is that you have to be diffusing an innovation. So you can preach to the choir about how bad things are or how you would like it to be, but unless you actually have an innovation that can help it be better, it will be frustrating. So implicit in this model as it pertains to social change 2.0 is you actually have to have a social innovation. You actually have to have the new thing that you want to see, whether it is a program to help someone lower their carbon footprint or to make the community more livable or disaster resilient or to change a culture. You actually have to have some innovation or build agency in a developing world context or empowerment. Without it, you're still playing at the effect of the 1.0 model, which is looking for someone else to create the change. So you actually have to have the innovation built, and that's a piece of work, to build a social innovation and to prototype it before you're ready to diffuse it. But assuming that you have that, and social innovation is such a powerful idea now because people intuitively or very consciously understand that what we need to create a different world is a set of new innovations that help us get from here to there. But once you have the social innovation, one of the misnomers that change agents often operate with is they say, don't preach to the choir. And they ended up, so here's where this piece of thinking becomes important. So Rogers talks about...
You know, David, I just noticed Brad has asked me to say something to you to try to keep your volume up a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, that would help.
I'll speak a little louder and get a little closer to the phone, and hopefully this will work. Sorry about that. So I'm on a pay phone because I'm not actually available. I'm on the road, and my cell phone doesn't work, so hopefully this will work better. It is an interesting phenomenon to have a payphone. I've been on one of those for a long time. So Rogers talks about four different stages in the innovation diffusion process. The first group he calls the early adopters. Everyone probably is familiar with the term early adopter. And they have two characteristics. They seek out the new, and they have a high tolerance for experimentation. And that early adopter population might be listeners on this radio broadcast or this web broadcast. They might be people who live on your block. They might be people who are in an organization or people on a board of directors. These are the people most responsive to the innovation or the new idea being disseminated. And what Rogers discovered was, and this is so different from the Tipping Point book by Malcolm Gladwell, this is a much more rigorous thing, body of research. When you hit about 15%, you hit a tipping point, or you can hit a tipping point if the social innovation is well-designed, well-architected, and capable of diffusing. Most are not. But if it is, it starts diffusing to the next group called the early majority, who are the belongers. That's the next 35%. And if the innovation has got legs, it can then go further to the next group called the late majority, who are only going to join when they feel they have no choice. And then the last group that Rogers talks about are the laggards, or the people who will never participate. And where social change agents get tripped up when they're trying to move a new idea forward, or trying, let's just say, climate change, and they get tripped up with the climate deniers, who are the laggards, who will never participate, and are never really worth trying to engage anyway. And they say, let's not preach to the choir, let's go after the laggards, and they spend all their energy trying to get people who will never participate. So from a social change point of view, what you want is an elegant way of moving anything forward. And if you preach to the choir sings loud enough and they get people in the church. If you are the, you know, let's should follow this all the way through, you know, the spiritual leader of this congregation, and you are the one trying to make the communication, it's not as easy, because what Rogers found is that the way we listen, the way we most respond is not the expert or the person with the innovation. It's someone who I trust, who's like me, the trusted messenger. So it's very essential that we learn how to get smarter as change agents, because otherwise we tend to project our frustration and say people are not willing, or where they're what's the word we often use, apathetic. And in fact, what I have concluded is that people are, if provided something that is going to be valuable to them, they want it. They just have to have it delivered in a way that is going to best work for them. So the real change is the upgrading of change agents and their skill set. That, to me, is where the leverage point is in the system.
Oh. Well, that upgrade of us as change agents and our skill set is something that you've been working on and that you work on every day, and you see measures of progress. I mean, I think in the kind of work you're doing, happiness is being a grandparent. That is, when you see people you're training becoming really highly effective and bringing about the inspiration and empowerment of others, you really begin to see it working. And I'm sure you've had ample experience of both, you know, gratifying validation and frustration and learning in that process. Can you give us kind of a report from the front about how the grandchildren and great-grandchildren project is going, and what that means to us as we join the family tree?
That's a great question. Well, it's slow progress. This is a big lift called human evolution. And building second-order change interventions is hard work and gratifying work, because you're seeing transformation in front of you all the time. It's like the kind of movie you go to where you see in the beginning someone's this place, and then they come out the other end and they have this transformational experience. It's very similar to what it's like when people go through that process as individuals on a more personal development place. But when you're trying to move a large system-wide change, it's slow, and it takes time, and it takes skill. And so one of the places that I'm always looking for in my work are how to make that easier. So where are the leverage points? So the operative lens that I see the world through are leverage points. So that there's a term from a book called Blue Ocean Strategy called disproportionate influence, which is a term that I like. So where do I see leverage points? Well, one of them is empowering people to be more skillful as change agents, for sure, because now we have created greater capability or capacity in the system, so that there's not as much spinning of wheels, which isn't the same as people who are trained being able to get something immediately to happen, but they are at least not spinning wheels. They're moving things forward, and they are on a path to get better and better at it, as am I. But the other leverage point is finding levels of scale where you have the most potential to have an impact. So if you're trying to change the world at the scale of an international institution like the United Nations and trying to get climate change legislation, for example, that's the least impactful place to leverage change, because all you've got are variations on the theme of the broken national government that we are now all showing up together in the same place trying to do something. So that's not very effective level of scale. We've observed that the national government is not a very effective level of scale to get anything to happen, because the system is so broken. And as we've talked about, from the diffusion of innovation point of view, if you need 51 votes or 60 votes to get anything through a Senate, for example, that means you have to get the late majority on board to start with. So all you're going to have is the most watered-down possible interventions or legislation. So clearly, you're not going to get anything that's remotely transformational or second-order change if you're operating at that level where you need that kind of dissipation of the whole system of, you know, 60% before you start. So then you move down to the next level, which is the state level, and I'm thinking, you know, let's say in the U.S., there's different other kinds of scale, but I'll just talk at a more practical level, political level, or you know, how our country is organized and our world's organized. And that's also not a very highly functional model. Some places it's better than others. In California right now, you've got a supermajority of progressive type of people, so you have a better chance to get stuff done. But still, it's at a state level, and it's very hard because they don't have a lot of leverage points or levers of control, other than command and control of the whole 1.0 system. But when you get down to the community level, you start to have a lot more potential. And ultimately, we are our world is a function of models that have to be put in place somewhere. So it gets a lot more, you have a lot more flexibility to invent and innovate. And then when you go down to the neighborhood or block level, neighborhood next, but then block, that's when you actually find the most power because you get to control it. It's a small enough size. And if you can build models from that scale and then take it to the next scale, neighborhood, and then to the next community, and then from there to other communities, you have the wherewithal. That is to say, if you can create social innovations at that level of scale and get it to work at that level of scale, it can be scaled much more easily. So part of being effective, in my judgment, as a change agent, is understanding what level of scale you have the most leverage, building your social innovation at that level of scale where you have the most leverage, and then designing a scaling strategy using the knowledge that Rogers brought into the system of diffusion of innovation. And so, you know, that begs one more question, which I will not get into at this point, but how does one build such a social innovation? And that's another whole part of my book, is how one can design and implement that. But fundamentally, assuming that one has something, then that's the process. And all of a sudden, from feeling impotent, you feel quite empowered because you have the skills and the knowledge and the social innovation and the right level of skill, knowing that you can build out from that level of skill to the next. You're enthusiastic, and you go forward, and then you're on the journey to actually make something happen. And most of the social innovations of consequence have happened at that level of skill and then diffused out from there.
Hmm. Now, it seems as if we're in a time, like when I step back and I look at what's going on in our world, I find myself looking at a need for such dramatic change in such a short period of time. It's analogous to the phenomenon of punctuated equilibrium when we look at the fossil record, that things don't seem to change very much for tens of millions of years or even hundreds of millions of years, and then in a relatively short period of time, perhaps less than a million years, there's quite a bit of sudden change and a new equilibrium is established. It's punctuated and there's this huge leap, and there's been adaptation to new conditions and often real advances. And it seems that we're at a time where our cultural evolution requires a tremendous level of dynamism, a real disruption of the current equilibrium. And yet revolutions and revolutionary change that really disrupts old order is usually violent and problematic in all kinds of ways. I don't think any of us want to live through a revolution. So we're interested in being evolutionary change agents, and yet we're interested in a speed of change that's revolutionary, which seems to create a contradiction in just in terms of our aspiration and intention. How do you integrate that?
Well, I don't know that anyone knows how to do what we have to do right now. I certainly can't claim that. And what I believe is that the moment in time we are in is a forcing function to grow. And people need now to, I mean, it's hard to be in a place with conscious people today as opposed to, say, 5 years ago or even 3 years ago, and certainly way different than, let's say, 10 years ago. I mean, I'm at this place called Omega Institute right now leading a workshop, and the last 3 or 4 years, what I've watched them evolve their mission into social change is now a key part of their mission. The group that we're talking about, the evolutionary leaders, it's now a key part of their mission, or wishes to be a key part of their mission. So wherever you look, social change, certainly wherever there are, relatively speaking, awake people, it's showing up. And that's a new phenomena. And also when you have that pull and you have a broken 1.0 system, as we see ourselves in now, it's a forcing function for learning because we want to survive. So we have to learn. Will we learn fast enough is an unknown. But will we learn? We will learn because we have to learn. Otherwise, the alternative is to just close down and contract. And if you're awake, even though that might seem like a nice thing to do, there's too much conflict that causes. So people have to wake up.
Yeah. No. I think that's the phase we're in. Yeah, we're at a moment in which I think that people, you know, when I work with this deeply with the people I teach, you know, there is an existential confrontation that is disorienting. Yeah. Much of our days, we're in a world that seems pretty stable, and we feel, you know, we don't think about the world crisis all day long and get disoriented by it. In fact, that's not even healthy. And we know that if we're to be a force for good in the world outside ourselves, we have to be essentially happy and humorous and in a way lighthearted, because there's a kind of fundamentally healthy, open-hearted clarity that is an absolute requirement to participating in a healthy way with other people and giving whatever gifts we have, even under conditions of crisis. It's not by being all tensed up and bent out of shape that we're going to show up with our best. And we also, though, see these daunting problems. And so we find ourselves with a profound existential challenge to be present to the world crisis in a real way and to make our lives meaningful and really find a way to link our daily activities. You know, many of us don't have a career like yours or even mine where the outer content of our daily activity, and you know, we may be obliged to a job that doesn't have direct relevance to these issues. You know, we may even seem to be working for a corporation that isn't even helping the situation, and yet people don't see another option other than to, you know, keep paying the rent and supporting their loved ones in whatever ways they do. And the disorienting dilemma that all of this represents generally causes people to go into denial for big chunks of time and then sometimes to kind of freak out and to be presented with a challenge to find our way to hold a profound inquiry in with beginner's mind, with a kind of openness and curiosity and a sense of possibility and an insistence on there being something that will yield and a kind of love of life, a gratitude for the miracle of existence. You know, even if we are in a moment shortly before a terrible period of evolutionary regression, you know, the sun will rise, and to not enjoy that sunrise is to betray life itself. And to somehow be an expression of that in life that wants to keep evolving and that is taking all of this seriously, and yet to do so in a way that expresses the unutterable wonder and gift that life and evolution is, and to be present to one another with those, with the tenderness and kind of dewy-eyed, you know, childlike awakeness of a fresh encounter with the miracle of existence, so that we're really empowered by that, is really quite it's an existential demand on the heart. So I work at the level of that with people, so that we can find our way personally to being engaged, at our best, and yet it's challenging because we think meta-systemically. Those of us who are involved in an integral view of things certainly do. And when we look at these meta-systemic dynamics, there are such powerful forces that seem to be locked into this sort of sleepwalk into the, you know, something close to extinction, or at least a terrible Mad Max dystopia, that it's very hard for us to stay with the detail of all of that at the same time. And I think an honest, candid, vulnerable conversation among people who care deeply and yet who are unwilling to let our upset destabilize us from a positive mode of engagement, both with our own personal awakening and with the awakening of others, is... it seems to me that there's a tremendous amount of work that we have to do in the trenches, and that maybe even the organizing work that we can do in our neighborhoods and so forth is going to be most effective if we can find our way to a level of intimacy and interchange with one another that's quite uncommon, in which we become vulnerable and intimate at a level that breaks through something of the usual trance. How do you feel about all of that?
Well, very articulate description of this dynamic we are in, and the need to be savoring life and existence as we try to save life and existence as human beings on this planet. So, thank you for that. And a beautiful vision, and very... very compelling, the way you shared that. So, one of the wonderful things about this moment in time is Paul Hawken had a version of this statement, and I remember it. It got very popularized through some talk he gave at Portland State University. And one can either see this moment as the worst possible scenario for humanity to be, and the pathway to a very dystopic future, and that's a possibility. Or one can see this as an extraordinary time for those of us who are transformationally minded and change agents to change the world. Because, to your point about punctuated equilibrium, these don't come very often. Maybe every million or two, who knows how many years. And certainly as a human being on this planet, I don't know that we've ever had an experience like this. I certainly, in my knowledge of the past, have not seen anything like this. So for me, this is an extraordinary time, if I choose to step in and be part of the solution. And so the thing that's so about now, unlike 10 years ago, is you could kind of hang out being neutral. You could kind of hang out in, you know, it wasn't that bad. It was sort of, you know, you could rant at how corrupt business might be, or government might be, or whatever your favorite pathology might be, and I'm not suggesting that government or business has to be that, but only that some people choose to project that onto those systems. and you can get away with it. But now, you can't. Just about lamenting how bad our national governmental situation is, or an oil company might be, doesn't get you very far. So you actually have to now be part of the solution. And so the question is how. How do you resolve the existential dilemma? It's easy. You be part of the solution. Doesn't mean that the challenges go away. It doesn't mean that it's any easier. It doesn't mean that the world is getting any better. It just means that for you as an individual, you being a collective you, you're now putting your energy towards making it better. And when people step into that kind of action, not just action for the sake of it, but skillful, effective, second-order type change, transformative interventions, they feel hopeful. Not necessarily believing that the world will make it, but hopeful they're part of making it better. And so a fundamental moment of truth is now upon anyone awake. You can't be neutral. And furthermore, if one understands the power of thought to influence, it's not just action, but thought itself and the influence of thought, the metaphysics of thought itself. If you choose despair, then you will actually diffuse that as well. So if you are in a state of despair, your contribution to the world, to everyone you talk to, will be more of the same, which will then continue to contract us as a species, because that just closes everyone down. So unless you can find a path forward that gives you some wherewithal to have, if not deep hope, at least feel possible or possibility about the future, then you're part of the problem. We're part of the problem who hold that thought. So it's a forcing function for evolution, absolute forcing function for evolution. And I would also say it's a forcing function for getting smarter about how to actually work more collectively. This is the goal of some of the work that you and I are about to do with one of the communities that we're part of, which is learning how to get high-performing people to actually work collectively so they can have greater impact. Because you can't do it by yourself. So that's the synergy piece, which is another part of the Social Change 2.0 model. How do you use synergy as an accelerator of social change? The shift from single-cell organism to multicellular organism. So, that's how I work with it and how I invite others to work with it, the existential dilemma that you've described.
Beautiful, David. This is such a vital conversation. It really wants to go on, and it will. But we're at the top of the hour, so it's time for me to make a few important announcements, and then we will continue, and we'll begin to invite some questions from some of our listeners as well. So if you have any questions for David or me, if you're listening by phone, raise your hand by pressing *2. And if you're listening by computer, you have that window in the Instant Teleseminar panel, and you can type in a question. So first, I want to make sure that everyone knows how to find out more about David's work. So I've mentioned some books, and this conversation we're having, focuses on his, I think I would call it your magnum opus. Is that fair, David?
I think I could own that one.
Yeah, Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World. But his other 10 books, and those by his wife Gail, and especially the ones they've co-authored, may also be of interest, particularly the book on personal transformation that they co-authored, Empowerment, The Art of Creating Your Life as You Want It. So to learn more about his work right away and that of his wife, Gail Straub, who's really his full partner in all this work and who's a remarkable person in her own right.
And soulmate,
absolutely. Please check out the Empowerment Institute, which you can find on the web, especially its certification and training programs, as well as links and more information about Social Change 2.0. And this is empowermentinstitute.net. Empowermentinstitute.net. I also want you to be aware of my work. My personal website is terrypatton.com, and you can find out about my schedules of teaching events. I'll be teaching at Esalen and Hollyhock in August in Canada at Hollyhock and in September at Esalen. And I'll be doing something called the Integral Living Room with Diane Hamilton and Jeff Salzman in October in Boulder. You'll find out about all that at terrypatton.com. But I'm especially wanting to stress this online course I teach in integral spiritual practice. This is where I help people get to down to the level of the kind of existential confrontation I was talking about. It was just released digitally for the first time, and just a couple of days ago I returned from teaching in Mexico as a guest of a team that translated this course into Spanish, and it was just wonderful to see a real sangha form around this work. And I found this particular trip deeply inspiring because the life transformations and practical projects that are issuing forth as people there are coming alive in the mystery of existence and activating their mission. This work is a basis for real life transformation. It brings together a tremendous range of wisdom in a way that really can shift your relationship to practice so that you can wisely exercise freedom to grow and explore widely in a way that brings profound coherence and depth to the growth processes that you engage. So it's an 8-session course, 8 90-minute sessions. It takes you through a step-by-step process that bridges you from being a seeker to being a practitioner in a way that's really uncommon, grounded in the most radical and embodied wisdom of the world's most highly awakened spiritual realizations, but not a hyper-masculine project of seeking. So it brings that practice onto the cushion and off of the cushion in a highly efficient and doable form you can integrate into a busy life. You can find that at terrypattencourse.com, terrypattencourse.com. And finally, please stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you about my next guest on this program, a remarkable woman named Linda Graham. Okay, let's see if we have some questions. Yes, we do. We've got several people who have raised their hands. Here's somebody who's calling in on Skype. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, Terry, this is River calling. Is the audio okay?
Yeah, we can hear you well. So tell us your name and where you're from.
River Judd. I live in British Columbia out in the Gulf Islands.
Welcome.
And, yeah, thanks. I am a long-time inner personal development type, meditation and Integral Institute and evolutionary spirituality type practitioner, which is a great benefit to me. I have a high importance on contribution. I really feel that is a very important aspect of my life. I want to contribute. I have technical background. I've been interested in renewable energy and climate change, etc., but quite unable to do much about it in a large way, to my disappointment. And I now also have recent notable financial setbacks with divorce and am 65. I'm worried about even my own housing ability. But my question is, what projects or approaches are there for perhaps legions of us who are in advanced countries or even developing countries where we are in limited circumstances and still really hear your message and must contribute for our own satisfaction?
I just swallowed something the wrong way. Hi, Ripper.
Hello.
I could use some of your water at the moment. I think I'm fine, though.
You have one.
Not that you have water, per se, but your name certainly evokes it. So there's different things that one can do. And it depends on really where you're drawn. I wrote a book called Low Carbon Diet, a 30-day program to lose 5,000 pounds, and people have taken that program, and it's done in peer support group with neighbors to become part of the global warming solution. And it's being done in different places. It's principally, it's kind of got an American basis at the moment. There's not a Canadian version of it, but a lot of people in Canada find that it's not too far off. It's also in a lot of other countries. It's been adapted and translated. So that's a what can I do in my block, can I do in my neighborhood, can I do in my personal life kind of book.
Right.
Beyond that, another thing that people have found really helpful is Social Change 2.0 study circles. And you do it together, and it requests that you find something that you want to do to make the world better at whatever scale. And at the end of each of the chapters are a set of questions that walk you through the design, step by step, of a intervention, social change 2.0 intervention. It's also a great community building opportunity. So that's the second thing that people find helpful. You know, they go up in orders of magnitude. A third one is that I teach a class called a Master Class on Transformative Social Innovation, which is based on that book, and that's another place that people come to learn. And then the most advanced work, not necessarily advanced in the sense of sophistication, but advanced in the level of commitment, and I guess I would say sophistication too, is our Empowered Student Certification Program, where someone comes to apply and understand this knowledge and build out projects with over a six-month time frame. So those are some of the ways that I personally could bring value to, or the work that I've done could bring value to what you're trying to do. But beyond that, I mean, I think that one just has to decide to make the commitment to look around and look for opportunities. There are endless opportunities. The real question is really the skillfulness in which you do the intervention. So just being part of an incremental solution isn't often very satisfying. So you want to look around and try to bring some of this kind of knowledge so that you can move something to the next level. You can get a transformational intervention. So hopefully that can be helpful to you, some of those ideas.
Yes, I will. I haven't read the two books, but I certainly am pointing in that direction. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. I wish you well with your quest to contribute or continue to contribute.
Yeah, perhaps we'll work together sometime soon. Thank you.
Thanks, River. Okay. Let's go to a question, a really thought-provoking one that Jim Nowler typed into the Instant Teleseminar window from Sacramento, California. He writes, I wonder, in an evolutionary view of change, if one perhaps needs to sit in the problem without viewing it as a problem, and thus letting the given situation find the innate urge to heal, or place it on a course of healing, a healing that is found in the so-called problem itself. What do you think about that way of viewing things, David?
What do I think about that? Well, I think that if you are going to be skillful as a change agent, so the assumption is that you are an agent of change, and that means taking some level of action. Some people are not choosing that, or their action is more inner, you know, praying for the situation or wishing, you know, wishing others well or what have you. But if you're actually seeing yourself as part of evolution itself, you can't hang out. So I don't know that I would define the issue as the problem as much as I would define it as an evolutionary juncture where we actually are being asked to evolve. Not unlike when chlorophyll was overwhelming the life support, the life of life on Earth from 850 million years ago, forcing the individual cells to come together into multicellular organisms, or else they would go extinct in life, as we know it would end. So the evolutionary moment in time that we find ourselves requires movement, and it requires us to be agents, active, engaged agents. How we do that is the place of growing right now as a life form, as a species. But I don't think there is a lot of room for just watching at this moment in time. So that's where I would, that's where I land. And of course, I have a bias towards change, but it's not just a bias. It's a requirement at this moment in time.
Well, you know, David, I'd like to engage on this question too, because, you know, being the more, you know, we could put these words in quotes, but, you know, more spiritually focused partner in this dialogue, I have a lot of sympathy with the disposition Jim is expressing, that there is something about taking a problematic view. I think something like the 75th dialogue I've had in this Beyond Awakening series, and many of them have been with spiritual teachers, and I remember several of them in which people who radiate a kind of radiance and happiness and who are spiritual teachers and sources and sources of transmission, you know, to thousands and thousands of people, have confronted me over the tendency for me to frame the issue that animates the series, the crisis on the planet, in problematic terms. And so at every turn, it's like this whole series of dialogues has been kind of a ratcheting up process for me, in which I notice the way I'm being problematic. I emerge from that into a fresher and non-problematic relationship to the dynamic. And then yet the urgency of change still remains present for me, but it's framed in a new, more limpid, clear, non-problematic way. At least I have an intuition of it. Not that I instantly stabilize a whole new existential shift, but I've certainly gone through a lot of existential shifts over the course of the, gosh, you know, 2.5 years that I've been doing this. And I think that it is important to open beyond a merely problematic and fundamentally, therefore, anxious and unhappy relationship to it. I think your commentary about how despair becomes a, you know, when we realize the metaphysical power of our thinking to transmit itself through the noosphere, optimism is a moral imperative, at least a fundamentally positive, constructive relationship to things is a moral imperative. Well, if you really awaken in a deeper way, you also realize that everything truly, truly is perfect as it is. If it is necessary for this incredible, beautiful human experiment to come to an end, then that necessity and us being in the red sky at sunset of it, and the incredible intensity of everything we love being threatened and rising to it, this is a spiritual opportunity that is beautiful. It's not a problem. It is what we are given. We are responsible to it. And now rising to it and being a part of a positive, proactive solution is absolutely urgent, but it does arise from my being more awake and more harmoniously related, less in conflict with the incredibly intractable challenges of our time. And for me, somehow there is no contradiction between emerging from a problematic orientation to all of this and finding a new order of urgency and intensity in my own way of living in relation to it. Does that resonate for you, David?
Well, I think you've stated the issue of the existential tension again from another angle. So I think that every one of us has to find our way with this really unforgiving moment in time where you can't rationalize the world away and just complain about bad politicians or this or that because of the one issue in particular of climate, because that is the one that we can't wiggle out of. We can kind of just deal with the created ecosystems, but we're, all of the systems are just all reaching this critical tipping point. And so it is a point of time when something it is needing to be born that's different. It's an evolutionary moment. And I don't actually have existential angst, personally. And so I think one has to find their own way. And the reason I don't have it is because I see this moment as opportunity-filled rather than this really bad place. I mean, I have to look reality in the eye. I look at, because of some of the major work I'm trying to do around climate change and scaling up this low-carbon diet in cities and scaling that up within the country, and, you know, it's a big, big, big idea. I'm on the front lines a lot with that. And so it's, I deal with people who are overwhelmed on a daily basis, I mean, by virtue of the science and the facts on the ground. So, but that's not how I choose to operate. I mean, I actually have taken to heart, I mean, you know, your worldview of how to live in the midst of all this is something I attempt to practice. And at the same time, there is, from an empowerment point of view, Terry, we talk about this empowerment model, and there's a three-part empowerment model. And the very first part of it is the shift from pathology to vision. And it's very, very fundamental worldview shift. And what tends to happen among people wanting to create change or a way of looking at the world is we tend to look at the pathology, the problem, and what's wrong, and the problem critique, and on and on and on. And we try to be problem solvers or whatever, and most of the books you read are critiques, analysis of the problem. And with our intellect, we can do that quite well. However, from a change point of view and an empowerment point of view, we are consistently, when we look at the world that way, defined, every solution is defined by the definition of the problem. That brings me back to my first question, which is what is the organizing question that I live my life by, which is what's possible, which starts to move us from pathology to vision. And when we move from pathology to vision for our lives, we start asking different questions. What's possible for my life, for my world? And then the only thing that defines our answers are our imagination. And so if you are now alive in a moment in time where everyone who could easily retire into apathy or just hanging out or in retreat mode, which is a path, a spiritual path, and I very much honor this, you know, I do spiritual retreats on a regular basis. That world is changing also because it's like there's a fire. You know, they talk about in change strategies, is there a burning platform if you're working in organizations? And if there's not a burning platform, it's hard to move. So we literally, albeit we can't quite see it unless you are paying attention, are living in a time when there's a burning platform. So when there's a burning platform, you got to move. So you can't stay on it or you'll burn up. So, you know, it's that's how I hold it. But the main thing is the choice of where we place our attention. Do we place our attention on the pathology and what's wrong? Or do we place our attention on the vision of what we want? You still have to deal with what is, but now you're moving towards possibilities. And that, to me, is exciting and profound because I believe that the human imagination, as Einstein said so well, is, you know, this incredible, he says it more eloquently than I'm about to quote, but, you know, it's way more than the knowledge. It's the creative process that's opening. I call that social creativity. And my work, fundamentally, isn't so much just training change agents. It's opening up the possibility for social creativity, and that enables social innovation.
Yeah, beautiful. And you really do stand in that with a great deal of consistency and power and rigor, which I so appreciate and admire. Well, let's take a live question from someone in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, or at least with a phone that has that 717 area code. The name that IDs here is M. Marthaler. Welcome. You are live. Please introduce yourself.
Thanks. This is Mike Marthaler. Actually, I'm in Portland, Oregon right now. And this latest bit of discussion you had really touched on what I was thinking. One of the areas that I've started this spiritual journey some years ago, struggled a lot, has been I'm a doer, a developer, a builder. I guess some people think of me as a visionary. Sometimes a voice in the wilderness, and as I've really looked at the spiritual side, I've sort of had a problem with the idea of, well, I'll just sit there and look at my belly button and watch the world, wait till the world changes. So this exchange that you just had is really good, and it really covered what I wanted to talk about, which is, like you said, I think some of us, there's a time to sit and deal with the spiritual, and then there's a time we just have to get out and take some action. And these programs that you're offering are extremely valuable. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. So I'll just make a comment on that. And again, it's where I started the conversation. And sometimes we see these things in kind of a tension or an opposite, and almost what I would call an either-or. The truth is, to do the work in the world, one does need to both have a spiritual practice, I believe. You can do it without it, but you're at a much more profound level of impact if you have it. And at the same time, you also need retreat time. I mean, I'm very conscious in my lifestyle, my wife and I, to take time for retreat, for reflection, for introspection, for regeneration. And the second part of this is, what an amazing spiritual practice, when, to your point earlier about the work that you do, to take it off the mat, so to speak, and be able to actually apply your spiritual knowledge in the world as you are doing it. It's not, you know, the way it's often done, just social action. And it kind of comes out of a pure value system, which is great. That is to say, like social action committees in a church or something, it comes out of a sort of religious worldview or something that we should give to the poor or do that. And you know, I'm happy that all that is happening. But it comes more out of an interior spiritual practice, the way I'm referring to it now, because my greatest opportunities is when I'm out, I put my idea out in front of the crowd, and I'm called naive or whatever I'm called, or someone rejects it, or someone's threatened by it, or someone attacks me, or whatever, just the world as it is. And or someone says, I want to play with you, but I don't know how. All of those now require me to put into practice everything that I have learned and everything that I attempt to be in the world. So it's a much more dynamic, spiritual, evolutionary new you, if you will, than just being in the introspective mode. So one needs the introspection. One needs to do that work. If one wants to really evolve more quickly, attempt to apply it around a real issue with real people, and watch your evolution in front of your own eyes. If you stay with it long enough, because you'll have to learn how to apply all those things.
Great. Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
We're pretty close to the end here, but I'd like to add, you know, then there are several people who have raised their hands on the phone and also have typed in questions that we're probably not going to get a chance to get to, so my apologies to those listeners. But
why don't we just stay on for another hour or two? You and I, Terry, we're good for that, but I guess
yeah. I think we begin to wear out our welcome with some of
all
our
right,
listeners.
Fair enough. But an hour and a half is like an amazing experience.
Yeah, it's a rich conversation, and that's the whole intention. Well, Drake in Bend, Oregon, asks for something very tangible and specific. Could you please give some examples of social innovations that started at a neighborhood level and moved outward and to larger scales?
Okay. Well, interestingly enough, I don't know if you're aware, but Bend, Oregon is one of the places where I've done work. There were about 9 cities where we built a program called the Green Living Program, which was to help people live more environmentally sustainable lifestyles through this peer support group called an Eco Team, who systematically over 7 meetings reduced their solid waste, they become more water efficient, energy efficient, transportation efficient, learn how to consume in a green manner, learn how to empower others. And that program formed 230 of these eco teams in Bend, Oregon. It was in the 90s. That model evolved into applying it in the inner city of Philadelphia on blocks where people had given up hope. And we connected the city and their citizenry in ways that had never been done before and built these really amazing livability experiences in places where there was high murder rates and crime rates and what have you. That model evolved into a program post 9/11 where I was invited into New York City called All Together Now to help build disaster resiliency. So this is like you're watching the evolution of a social innovation. And that model has now evolved into the low carbon diet, which I've talked about. And all of those programs have evolved into an initiative now called the Cool City Challenge, which is designed to find a leverage point. This is kind of a good conclusion probably moment around the issue of climate change. And if the 1.0 top-down systems have closed down at an international and national level, can we do it from the bottom up? And why I think we can is because 70% of the planet's carbon comes out of cities, and 70% of the city's carbon footprint comes out of citizens. If you can empower an individual citizen in small peer support groups at a block level, that also increases their livability and their resiliency while they're at it to lower their carbon footprint and scale it up to 25, 50, or 75% of the city, and get 25% or more carbon footprint reduction, which is what the Cool City Challenge is attempting to do in 3 Northern California cities. And that works. And I would add one other thing. If you can do that, you're also creating demand for new technologies, for green economic development, and new policies to be implemented. You have the means for a bottom-up intervention to address climate change, which is what most of my life now is devoted to, which is why I've been just traveling pretty extensively to get this program off the ground. So that's what it would look like, and that comes out of years of work and the recognition of where the leverage points are, of the understanding about the diffusion of innovation, of the building of social innovations that change behavior, and on and on. So to learn more about that, visit my website on empoweringinstitute.net, and you'll see, and go to transformative social change, and there's a whole section on the Cool City Challenge and what that's trying to do. And another very cool place you might want to visit is another part of our website. It's actually a different website. It's called imagineprogram.net, And that talks about our social innovation trying to bring agency or empowerment to disenfranchised women in the developing world, and that's in 8 countries. So those are examples of what this all looks like, what a second-order change intervention, a game-changing intervention, or a game-changing aspirational intervention looks like from our point of view.
Well, thank you, David. This is really at the center of the whole purpose of this program. I often conclude an interview feeling that we've gone very deeply into something of tremendous value, but which doesn't as fully face the challenge of our world crisis as fully as I want it to. And this interview is a notable exception to that, and I really want to thank you. I think you're leading in a direction that we all need. So let me tell you a little bit about what's coming up next week, but first remind you, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register at the series at beyondawakeningseries.com, and if you want to learn more about David, make sure to read his books and visit empowermentinstitute.net. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com and just sign up for my mailing list and certainly find out about the other things I'm offering. Now, in just a little less than 3 weeks from today, or a little more than 3 weeks from today, on Monday, the 17th of June, and this will be at 5 p.m., not at our usual time, I'm really looking forward to speaking with Linda Graham, whose latest book is Bouncing Back, The Neuroscience of Resilience. This particular interview will be especially rich with experiential exercises that will guide you through processes that make use of the latest neuroscientific discoveries to increase your personal resilience, balance, clarity, and effectiveness. So that's Monday, June 17th at 5 p.m. Well, thank you, David, and thank you, everybody. It's been a really rich conversation, and I'm very grateful for it.
Terry, you're most welcome, and I just want to take a moment to acknowledge you for the depth of your questions and the depth of your yearning to find truth and in an honest and rigorous way. It is a great pleasure to engage with you, and it has been a pleasure, so thank you.
Well, thank you so much, David. Okay, well, everybody, goodbye. We're done. I'm going to ring a bell.